Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. And welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Emily Ng, who's a postdoctoral researcher at the Amsterdam School for Cultural Analysis at the University of Amsterdam. And she'll be talking about her new book, A Time of Lost Gods, Mediumship, Madness, and the Ghost After Mao, which was published in 2020 by University of California Press. As we plunge ever deeper into an era for which post-Cold War, or in the case of China, post-Mao, seems like a more and more outmoded label, questions nevertheless remain about how to understand China's mid to late 20th century from the vantage point of the present. Many people inside and beyond China agree that this was a time of great upheaval and disorder for society at large. Yet as Emily Ng shows in A Time of Lost Gods, there are those who offer a different view. From a rural standpoint at the very heart of the country in Henan province, a group of people collectively termed spirit mediums look back on the Mao era as a time of relative peace, when a powerful sovereign brought cosmic order to both human and beyond human realms. Since the death of Mao, a new kind of disorder has conversely brought unpredictable capital flows, out-migration, and intergenerational strife to the world, dispatching a flood of ghosts and spirits to team into newly formed cracks between social, economic, and political relationships. Drawing on fieldwork in rural Henan, Emily Ng delves into these fissures, drawing out a fascinating range of perspectives on China's post-Mao era. These are drawn from Ng's deep engagement with the work of spirit mediums themselves, the lives of ordinary villagers who consult them, and also patients in a local psychiatric ward, whose concerns at times overlap with those of the mediums. While offering a rich portrait of all things cosmological at China's very heart, this book is in fact extremely difficult to sum up, spanning as it does a wide variety of themes critical to understanding the country's recent past and present. From religion and ritual, to class, gender, generation, money and migration, and from ghosts to communist officials, and indeed ghosts of communist officials, such a rich range of themes makes it into this beautifully written text that it often seems to be weaving its own cosmology. And so it's lucky that the author is here to tell us more about all of this. So I'll say, Emily Ng, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. And thank you for that really wonderful introduction.
Well, hopefully it somewhat represented some of the things that are in the book. But if it didn't, then please do say some things to indicate what you think is in there. But before we get on to that, I'll begin by asking you how you got interested in these topics China and cosmology and all of the things that you have researched.
Yeah, and so the book itself came out of my PhD work at UC Berkeley in medical anthropology. And at that time, I had been interested in the theme of madness in general and had done some previous work in a psychiatric hospital in Shenzhen, so a relatively urban space that was at the time, in the early 2000s, over 90% labor migrants, essentially in the hospitals. There were many young labor migrants who had fallen ill. And so I was at the time trying to understand patient experiences of bipolar disorder. And I was really curious, what was this other world that people were coming from that I hadn't really spent much time in the villages. And I was also somewhat moved, but also somewhat stuck on certain critical approaches to psychiatry and psychology. and questions of disciplinary power and closure, where Mandis doesn't speak to anything in particular after a particular historical moment, or there's some kind of mark of coercion. And I didn't really get the sense of how one could think oneself out of that loop, let's say, or that kind of conceptual frame, and how one could think Mandis otherwise. And I knew that there were some references in the literature, obviously, to other traditions, but I myself had not encountered them. So it was very difficult for me to think Mandis conceptually outside of the psychiatric frames that I myself had learned them through. And so I think that I was curious about what would it be to think through something like possession, both experientially and conceptually. And that was something that I wanted to understand a bit better, because it was a little bit outside of my imaginative capacity, even though it's such a classic theme in anthropology.
Right, right. Yeah. So you approach it from this pretty unique angle, starting, if you like, yeah, from something that's at the other end of some kind of spectrum and following it back towards its, I don't know, origin point or sort of up the scale somewhere. But I mean, just to kind of follow up on that, do you mean that the experiences you had in Shenzhen suggested that the sort of psychiatric lens, or the way that people were received in the hospitals and so on in Shenzhen, didn't quite fit their sort of the place they were in and what they were experiencing?
No, it actually precisely was that it seemed to fit, particularly for the younger generations. It seemed that they were seeking out a language from within Western psychiatric and psychological concepts. So people were interested when they knew that I was curious about mental health, for instance. And they were not looking for, you know, other, I guess I was just caught because it felt like the answers would come from within these Western concepts, and they were looking for them there. And at the same time, I think within the literature, there was a sense of entrapment by these discourses. And I didn't want to hear the people that I was meeting, the younger people, the labor migrants, in terms of only their thinking themselves into this kind of never-ending loop of a neoliberalization that they were just stepping further and further into. And at the same time, I didn't know what would offer other grammars for thinking about these themes. So I think that it was more of it was almost a black hole in my own thinking. And they themselves, at this point, I understand that they might be those who during the holidays go home and do engage in these other languages in their hometown, for instance. But in the setting of the hospital, those conversations didn't really come up. And so I think that that was part of my curiosity as well. I didn't know these other kind of ways of thinking existed. I wasn't sure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, without getting kind of too immediately into the anthropological weeds, that is, I think, a really fascinating approach to something which may be a widespread kind of anthropological conundrum in some ways, right? I mean, if you're approaching, a place that is manifestly not, a seat of Euro-American kind of neoliberal thinking, you're looking for something often that is different from that. And yet there are contradictions that emerge when things like, in this case, psychiatric care or other sorts of things that have a certain sort of Euro-rootedness are willingly embraced in those places. You're left in a bit of a kind of tricky place trying to find what is the, how do we look for something more authentic or more rooted in a kind of local cultural context here, if, what is being very willingly engaged in is something that, may have a sort of imported background or something.
Right, right. And I don't think that I had a sense that there was going to be a truly authentic version of whatever it would be, because I think that the younger people I had met experienced the idea of tradition as something somewhat rigid and persecutory. And so I knew that there was an issue there that wasn't just neutral, and there wasn't something to be easily found. But I also got the sense that there might be something that's different, but I didn't know exactly what it was, if that makes any sense. So not in the sense of an uninfiltrated or untouched, origin, but in the sense of there is some pain that's being experienced around this concept of culture and generation, and it might look differently elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Well, I think you, the book itself is an expression of a non-conclusive kind of adherence to one or other or some search for authenticity. It's absolutely not that, because the way that you weave, both your sort of fieldwork experiences in a local hospital in your field site, which we'll come on to in a second, and the activities of spirit mediums and people who consult them in that place, is exactly all about that sort of entanglement and difficulty of extricating these things as you know, somehow separate languages or idioms or anything like that. So I think, you know, we're already dealing in the abstract somewhat, so maybe it would help us to delve into the book itself, now we know something of where it came about and where your own sort of curiosity took you. So you did pick Henan, central China, as a place to go and investigate some of these questions. And you call it, in the introduction, you refer to it as the China of China.
Yeah.
So could you explain a bit about what that term means, or through explaining what that term means, explain a little about why you picked that place and what it was that was significant about going there?
Yeah. And so I came across the term in a book by Ma Shuo from the early 2000s. And so the book would be loosely translated like something like "Who did the Henanese offend?" or something like that. And so essentially, this was around the middle of my fieldwork that I ran across the text, and I had already been imagining the movement from the urban area to the rural and back, and kind of this in between movement as a movement toward a kind of a space of hollowing in the national imaginary. I really got the sense that people were telling me, "Don't go there." And don't go there because it's either not a good place, people would say it's a bad place in whatever layer of senses. It's poor, its intentions are not the most well-origined, it's a place full of thieves and charlatans. There are all of these caricatures that have mapped onto this place. And at the same time, people would say there's nothing there. And this is something that people said in the cities, as well as after I arrived, there were people there who said, "Why? What are you doing here? There's nothing here." And so it was really from this sense of nothingness. Before I went, there was a sense, it was a space of badness and nothingness. And then once I got there, people were still telling me there's nothing. And so in the sense, in the middle of trying to think this hollowness in the imagination, I ran across this book, and I thought the China of China was a kind of way, both the title itself, as well as the Ma's analysis of Henan as a kind of internal exteriority upon which people in China kind of projected their own sense of certain historical aspects of what became despicable about China symbolically. And so, I mean, his is obviously a very particular read, and not everyone would agree, but I think that he captured something about the sentiment toward the place that rang really true to me between the layers of philanthropic imaginations of poverty and the kind of sense of self-loathing that's embodied in that. And so I thought, and then at the same time, there was a question of civilizational center. So it was the heart of the Chinese civilization in some sense. So the older imaginary of a cosmopolitical center, and then the much newer imaginary of this collapsed, hollow place led to a doubling that then China is essentially this middle space, not quite. So Henan is also not quite the poorest, not quite the richest. China on a global map, not quite the poorest and not quite the richest at that moment in history. And so this place of lost nowhereness and a kind of anguish about itself became the what was encapsulated in the sense of what does it mean to be China to something. And so I think for me, the sense of also trying to how to think a place, a very particular place, like the place I call Hexian, without just moving back to the empiricism of then counting what is this place compared to other places, and then what is China in terms of the facts that we can find out about it, but a kind of different kind of conceptual scaling that becomes possible with this kind of twist of this term. Because I think that became more important to me, not that the empirical side is not important, but I think that there's something to the imaginary side that became very powerful in its influence on where I went. So it also allowed me to move across space in a way that seemed more appropriate to the place.
No, well, absolutely. And I think the kind of scalar movement that you just described, or the kind of way of reading places and also or a whole variety of scenes at different scales, national or local or transnational, or indeed, you know, I suppose also at some kind of cosmological remove, all interweave very well in the book. And actually, you know, the relationship you trace between, you know, very grounded, empirically observed occurrences and much wider scale insights about this question, as you put it, of China's kind of reflections on what China is, which, you know, do float to the surface, I think, often strikingly often, even in quite local contexts, including in encounters with, I guess, foreign anthropologists. It's something that is a really strong theme of the book as a whole, and I think what makes it somewhat genre leaping and difficult to encapsulate, as I mentioned in the introduction. Just onto Hexian then, and some of the things that go on there. This location you call Hexian. You have already described, you know, your sort of interest in looking for some other idiom of or mode of engaging with these questions of madness, as you put it, or of other sort of, I don't know, states of mind and so on. So who were the spirit mediums, I guess, is a sort of fundamental question that is immediately there. What does the term imply? What sort of terms exist on the ground for these people? And what do they do?
I want to, maybe you can loop this back into the earlier part a little later. I realized that one other thing I want to mention with relation to the China of China concept was the rural and the peasantry were also really central in thinking about Henan as a place for me and I think for the national imaginary. So part of the fact of centrality was that it's the agricultural heart. It's one of the agricultural hearts and conceptual centers that then got displaced by another imaginary in which the post-reform one, in which capital was reinvested in the coast. So the heart became the hollowed heart in a time of rural outmigration toward the cities after the death of Mao. And so I think that sense of outward movement and the peasantry losing its previous symbolic significance under Mao, and we can talk about this a little later as well, that was also central for what it meant to be the China of China to me.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, I don't think we need to necessarily even loop that back in. I think that is excellently okay. Added context to what we'll now move on to with the spirit mediums and so on. So, do continue with the spirit mediums and consultations, indeed, with this sort of rural, I guess, peasant place.
Yeah, so the people who I'm translating into the broader term spirit medium in English are kind of bringing together several terms in the Chinese or the Hunanese. And it's not quite the same as the way that people usually do it in the literature on, you know, quote unquote, popular religion in China. People tend to consider spirit mediums those who have a home altar where supplicants or clients go and visit and consult. And so I'm including that, you know, let's say category of people who there in Hexian would be called kanxiangde, so those who see or observe incense. Because incense is always used in the sessions, and there's a relationship between the gaze and the flame and the signals that of how the incense, each incense stick burns. So that's one type of person. But I'm also bringing in people that I met at the temple square. So there's a main temple in Hexian, and then there are many, many other ones. I spent a lot of my time on the sort of open square right outside of the temple gate, where many people spent their time, kind of thousands of people would go on ritual days and the 1st and 15th of the lunar month. And then those who I'm calling spirit mediums are those who hang around on even the less normatively ritually significant days. And there would be, you know, groups of people from anywhere from, you know, 50, 100, depending on the day, who are there with ritual spreads, with objects, with doing spirit writing, cultivating, sometimes singing, sometimes reciting poetry, and all in their own ways, idiosyncratic ways, they would be essentially doing the work of their tutelary deities or spirits, you know, singular or multiple, depending on the person. And so this is the type of person I'm also calling spirit medium, in the sense that they are channeling the work or duty of spirits that to whom they are they've made a pact with. And so I think in the general literature, people might refer to this as something, might pull this more toward something like temple pilgrimage. But I'm calling also these people mediums because they're not only visiting temples, which is a much broader kind of movement or a much broader category of people. I think these are people who've experienced themselves as being chosen and designated and being communicated with on a daily basis of where they should go in order to undertake a task for deity. And so to open a home altar and take in supplicants is just one particular task that might be undertaken. And there might be other forms of tasks, such as showing up at a particular temple with particular ritual implements and burning particular amounts of paper money or burning particular amounts of incense in the name of something. And this something is often secret. You know, it's between the person and their tutelary spirit. So it's not really to be known or to be asked. So I couldn't always ask what it was for, but people would say it's from above, which just meant shangmianshi. So it just meant from the heavens, essentially. And so the reason that I bring the two sides together, this kind of more public presence of this relationship with the invisible world and the more kind of classic sense of, you know, the supplicant and the medium at their ritual table, is that I feel like they stage different sides of the cosmology today. And so it's not only in the consultation that the question of history and spirits is speaking, it's that there's a kind of public open staging of what it is that's off and at a disjuncture in historical and cosmic time. Something is amiss and unaligned. And so people are present at the temple square to realign this particular moment. And then those in the consultation kind of table are dealing with individuated issues that also have something to do with these times. So this is through forms of haunting or questions of, you know, it could be very quote-unquote ordinary things, marriage, work, money, etc. It's not that it's always about something cosmic in the supplicant's terms, but what frames all of the issues and the hauntings that are arriving at the present is something that becomes central to the book, which is that in the contemporary cosmology, the reason that there are these hauntings and spirits today is because of the death of Mao. And so in their cosmology, the lifespan and reign of Mao actually marked one of a kind of positive, a morally positive disappearance of spirits. So the spirits vanished, but not in the sense of religious persecution. The spirits vanished because Mao was a more powerful spirit who then protected China from total foreign imperial overtake and destruction. And so there was a sense that spirits that were becoming corrupt or dark were essentially sent out by the earthly presence of Mao. And Mao himself was sent down, in fact, from the heavens, and he himself did not know this. So there was a question of an arrival of sovereignty and a sovereign banishing of spirits that shouldn't be there at the time. And so Mao's death was seen as a risky moment in which sovereignty, a divine sovereignty, was withdrawn, and the spirits who were corrupt, fake, there was a language of fake gods, so spirits that were corrupted and fake returned to haunt the contemporary moment. And so basically for the mediums, the present is filled with the sense of haunting as a result of the end of the Maoist era.
Right. Hence the need, I suppose, for all of these various personae, you know, as mediums, as people mediating between these different realms and as a way of, as you put it, to sort of fix things that are out of joint for a wider group of people visiting the square and the temple and these individual people too.
Right.
I just wonder though, could you say a little more? I mean, for I think including people such as me who are not sort of specialists or kind of particularly knowledgeable about the broader sort of traditional or indeed contemporary religious scene in China at large. Could you say a bit more about this sort of whole cosmological setup, basically the kind of idea of the spirit world and the human world, and how that sort of how what you encountered and your sense of what it was these people were mediating between related to, I guess, some more classic descriptions of how these kind of realms interact in more, I suppose, historical or sort of traditional Chinese folk religion.
Yeah, definitely. So I think, well, I think all of it, this has to be prefaced by the kind of the history, and many scholars have done wonderful work on this. Rebecca Nettostup, who's done work on superstitious regimes, on how anti-superstition campaigns across nationalists and Maoist eras essentially transformed the entire religious landscape in China, and many others. And so basically, whatever counts as Chinese religion today, or whatever becomes called Chinese religion, is already influenced by, you know, over a century, well, I suppose centuries of missionary encounter with the West, etc. So Chinese religion as a concept and category, as many who, you know, also work beyond China are probably familiar with, who work on religion, has been channeled through Western lenses of what qualifies as religion, what should be counted, what should be named a religion, quote unquote. And so missionaries had gone in search of what is the, or what are the Chinese religions. And without trying to summarize that history, I think that what had happened across the different moments and the different moments of governance was that some major strands were selected out of this missionary imperial, you know, history in which Christianity, Catholicism, Islam, Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism were picked out as official religions. And this was a very long and complicated process. But what got, in a sense, left over was this category, almost a loose category that came to be called popular religion in the literature, that which didn't quite belong in any formalized, you know, space, but also that which was diffuse and kind of everyday in its practices. So there's different ways in which this concept of the popular, quote unquote, is used. And I think for in my work, I'm taking that up as a kind of upside down role. So a medium becomes something of a quote unquote popular religion because it has been, mediums as a figure have been written out of officialdom when it comes to recognized religions. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with the presence of the spirit world in general. So on the side of, for instance, on the side of healing, Chinese medicine has also cleaned up some of the aspects. The formally recognized version of Chinese medicine has written out some spirited parts as well. So through these kind of historical moves to clear out the spirited aspects, then what remains is this kind of, are these regional practices of mediumship that then don't get allowed in the formal temples. And so, yeah, you can stop me if I'm getting too long in my description. But one of the very old, classic, but also, you know, still strong divisions is just that of yin and yang. And it wasn't really until I spoke to some friends who are conversant with the China literature but don't work in China that I realized oftentimes people don't mention that it's not just, for instance, a Chinese medical or symbolic concept, the yin and yang, is that the yin world is actually considered the world not only of coldness, darkness, and certain medicinal properties, but it's also the world of the invisible and the world of ghosts, and in a sense, the world of gods as well. And so, and the yang or yang world is considered the world of the living, the visible, and the human. And so in that sense, there is this very broad divide between the living invisible and the non-living in the usual sense and the invisible. And people are always traversing this kind of terrain of what I end up calling a cosmic doubling. So any entity, any words, any objects can potentially have meaning and force in these realms, in the kind of human, what we might call secular realm, as well as the cosmic or spectral or invisible realm. And many people beyond people who consider themselves mediators of spirits talk about the world in that way as well. But there is a lot of contention after decades of these anti-superstition campaigns. There's a lot of contention around whether or not these worlds are real, whether or not they should be engaged. There's a lot of tension within families, across generations, across gender. So that's the, I'm not sure if that quite answers what you were asking, but this is part of the landscape.
It absolutely does. Cause what it draws out is that sort of tension, I guess, between some of the modernizing, formalizing dynamics that have characterized some of the grander historical epochs that I think are part of your sort of understanding or part of your analytical frame in some ways for approaching these things, but also some of those tensions on the ground, as you say, between generations or between kind of more demotic practices and ways in which these things are framed compared to more formalistic, I guess, state categorizing regimes and so on. So I think that's all super useful. I guess since you've also just brought us back to that question of the hidden and the dark, secret kind of world, I think one practical question which may have benefited from being earlier than this now quite middle point of the conversation, but I guess just on the front of how you actually did this work, you said already that there was some things that you obviously were not able to fully understand or kind of ask directly about, just because there were things that could not be disclosed to you. But even on the level of gaining trust and being among people who are kind of dealing in this at this sort of juncture, mediating between these realms, how practically speaking did you get in with these people, to put it bluntly?
I suppose it took time. That's the most, maybe one of the more important dimensions. And also a bit language, because I think I had underestimated the gap between standard Mandarin and Hunanese dialect. And so it took me a while to kind of get a sense of, both what people were talking about and as well as speak in a way that wasn't so, it marks one immediately by speaking standard Mandarin there. People don't use it locally. And so one's immediately perceived as, someone who's there for purposes of gain. And so I think that it took, I was living with the family, and then I asked them what kinds of practices are common. And I ended up meeting friends, neighbors, and started going with people to mediums when they were, in need of a visit. And I also spent a lot of time just asking around in general, who are some well-known mediums, what mediums were in the region. And I would show up and, try to see if they were interested in speaking. Some were more, some were less. And I also just spent a lot of time at the temple and the temple square, just, I suppose, lingering in a sense. And I write a bit about lingering in the book, but the act of lingering itself, I think, both in my initial confusion of how to really understand what was going on and understand what people were trying to get at. And also, after a while, I realized that was also the act. That was also their act, was an act of lingering. And I ended up thinking in the book through Berlant's idea of animated suspension, so that there was a kind of suspension of regular temporality there, and people would go and spend their whole days, which is also why people would fall out of the regular economy of things, not necessarily go to work or wage labor and just spend day and night at the temple. And so there was a kind of pausing of time in order to critique time in a particular way by mediating these, how I'm thinking about mediating these cosmic histories. And so essentially at the practical level, I ended up just going day after day because I also, I just found it really, it drew me in what people were speaking about, singing about, what they were staging in a sense. And interestingly, as a counterpoint, I think, you know, in a lot of day-to-day life outside of the temple, there was a lot of talk of money and pragmatics and labor and work and more money. And I think the temple square was one of the spaces in which this kind of draw toward wealth and this kind of fracturing of families in the middle of rural outmigration and this kind of break between generations and this impossibility between generations was really being spoken about and articulated through various genres. I didn't write that much, but about the Hunanese opera genre. So there were songs as well as these kind of half poetry, half spoken instances. So essentially that's how I spent my days. And I think as when I was there for long enough, people also got the sense that I was there for something and something they felt like was beyond academic research. And I didn't, you know, I would tell people I'm here as a researcher and they would say, well, everyone winds up here for reasons they don't know. And so I think that was part of the engagement as well.
Yeah, there are lots of cases of kind of you relating exchanges, which indicate that people see you as you know, I think as incorporated and as adopted as one can hope to be, you know, as someone, as you said, they're present for research purposes. You know, I think how people's sort of framing of what they see you to be doing and how they see your research in relation to their own concerns, it's something that comes out very nicely as a self-reflexive element of the book too. So that's really interesting to hear, and actually leads us on quite well, I think, to what I wanted to ask next. And we've already touched on some of the key concerns of chapter one, which frame more of this question of rurality and the peasantry, I suppose, in Chinese history, and I guess that sort of as a basis for looking at Hexian and Henan in particular. So I thought we might move on to the second chapter, which actually focuses precisely on this Fuxi Temple Square, Fuxi Temple being the name of that main temple that you've already alluded to, where you spent so much time lingering. And from that scene, I guess you draw out some inferences about the place of Mao in particular. And he's come up, but he's also in the title of the book, so he probably deserves a bit more attention than we've given him. So I wonder kind of what you could say more about the spirit medium practices that center on Mao. How sort of Mao's place in actual mediumship between human and spirit realms occurs these days, how he sort of hovers over things, and more broadly what that tells us about some of these more sort of broader historical or historicity and temporality based themes that you've also touched on, but I wondered if you could flesh out a bit more in terms of understanding the post-Mao era. There's a lot there, I know, but
Well, to briefly return to the peasantry theme. So I, you know, in the first chapter, I had kind of, there was an arc from the rise of the peasantry in literary and political figurations in kind of the early 20th century. And so the sense that in order to be a modern nation, one has to deal with its others, women, peasants, etc. And so they came into writing and into a kind of question of representation. And the Maoist moment did something slightly different, which brought out this revolutionary potential and in the figure of the peasantry. And so at the, you know, again, without going into too much detail, at the moment, the Soviet vision of revolution was very urban centered. It was a sense of a proletarian revolution from the factories. And I think Mao and his mentor and those around him, there was a certain impasse because China at the time was so deeply in proportion agrarian. And so in some of the early communist writings in China, something took place between the 20s and 30s that allowed the peasantry to actually become the figure of the heart of Chinese revolution and therefore also a world revolution of a kind of suffering of the world congealed on Chinese peasant bodies so that there was a kind of class warfare that would be possible based on the suffering of the peasantry. And I think that this vision, you know, as problematic as it is and as much as people debate about how it was actually carried out, I think this image really held steady for the people that I met in Hexian. And so it was still very fresh in the mind that one could embody the political subjectivity of a heroic peasant revolutionary, and that capacity for imagining oneself in that world historical time that launched into the future really shifted, I think, after the post-reform moment in which the rural regions became, quote unquote, backwards once again. And it just becomes a sinkhole of time that moves in a different direction. And so I think it's in partly, in not only, but partly in this context that most people I met in Hexian were relatively supportive of Mao, and they had been, at least according to their accounts, very supportive of Mao during his lifetime, and they remain loyal in their accounts of Mao and in their sense of a region that was loyal to Mao. And so I think it's not out of nowhere that this sense, the sense of the mediums of the cosmic implosion that occurred after Mao's death and disappearance, was very much aligned with the hearts and spirits of the people who were all around. And there was a sense that things were, you know, I would ask, well, weren't things difficult there? Because it's a region also known for the very intense Great Leap famines in the late 1950s. And people would say, yes, but famine was worse prior to Mao. You know, with Mao, at least we had food to eat. And, you know, there was some suffering was necessary, but things got better and better. So, you know, that was the sense that I got there, that Mao's death almost felt as if it was yesterday. And in the accounts of daily life now, whatever now means, was always paired with the yesterday of Mao's passing, even though it had already been, you know, 40 plus years. And so I think it was in this, it was in this setting that there was a sense that Mao was a kind of withdrawn sovereign. And so for the mediums, his presence was one that actually still gazed at the present. And so he was mourning. In a sense, he could still see everything that was going on beneath, but he didn't have the power to return in embodied form anymore. And so essentially, at the Temple Square, one would hear people recite the poetry of Mao by heart. People would sing revolutionary songs from the Maoist era, sometimes alone, sometimes together. People would wear People's Liberation Army or Red Guard uniforms in part of their rituals. Icons of Mao were placed next to Buddhist or Taoist or regional icons of different deities. And so he was seen as part of the scene of the other, the invisible world, and not external to it and not against it either. And so people would often say that Mao was sent from the Buddhist family. Not everyone, this wasn't the exact account of everyone, but I think it was common among the people at the Temple Square that Mao, one of the unspoken, the public secrets, and it was often coded. So the question of Mao, an emperorship, the color yellow. So there were signals seen in objects and colors. And so the public secret account was essentially that Mao was sent from the heavens by the Buddhist family and possibly by the Maitreya Buddha. And some would say he was Maitreya himself. And so there was a sense that he was both gone and pointing to the future, and that everything that was staged around and that was happening pointed, somehow gestured back toward him and his absent presence. So some of this was material in the sense of pins and icons and uniforms and buttons and songs. And some of this was just the way that the spirit world seemed to revolve.
Right. Yeah. And I think, yeah, your allusion to those kind of that paraphernalia, if you like, of that era kind of gives a sense of the texture of how that time is looked back on, how it's experienced, albeit because of, I guess, a lot of material austerity in the country at large. You know, it's somewhere where a certain aesthetic, a certain color palette, mm-hmm. and so on, is very vivid and lives on in a way which I think is, you know, it's more compelling to suggest a connection between all of those links, as well as the musical forms, the relatively standardized repertoire of Red songs and so on that you also mentioned there. It's easier to make that connection between that and the figure of Mao as a historical persona, you know, I think, than it might be, you know, in other broader contexts, and also gives, yeah, this sort of fascinating cosmological account, if you like, or cosmological understanding of certainly the post-Mao condition, and perhaps also this sort of post-socialist term, which is so debated in its relevance to China. But yeah, moving forward then, you kind of delve into some of the specific activities of some of the mediums and their activities in consultation with the ordinary residents of Hexian, including dream interpretation and interactions with ghosts and so on, which themselves also kind of relate to key events of that Mao period during the Cultural Revolution, during the famine, which you've also mentioned too. But since, you know, we don't have an eternity of time to talk about all of these things, I thought I'd move us on, sort of coming full circle back to some of your interest in the psychiatric ward, or in the kind of more medicalized or hospital-based life of some of these ideas, some of these concepts. So it's the latter two chapters that kind of delve into some of these questions. So could you sort of say something more about, you know, as you sort of came to understand these themes that we've talked about so far, in relation to your initial motivation, your initial interest there in the question of psychiatric care, and you know, the kind of starting point that you had, how do these two registers, or these two spaces or modes, interact with one another? And how do these kinds of themes of generational or epochal change or rural emptying manifest themselves in the psychiatric ward specifically?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that space in. And so in that particular place, the hospital and the temple were sitting right across from each other. And so there was a sense that the temple was a space of madness. It's was locally known as a place where somewhat mad people go. And that usually referred to, you know, the people who I'm calling the mediums. And at the same time, there was a kind of mutual reference. So I write about a large TV screen that had that circulated different advertisements. And one of the advertisements was for the psychiatric ward across the street. And so there was a kind of locally known sense that there was a crossing between something about the temple square encapsulated a question of madness that was also being raised at the psychiatric ward, or the psychiatric ward was a site where one would deal with the question that were at the temple square. So on the one hand, some people, you know, quite literally circulated between the two. I write about the case of a medium who was hospitalized for a while. And at the same time, it's by no means were all people who experience a possession or consider themselves mediums hospitalized. Yet in many of the accounts, the life accounts of the mediums, they do say that the moment of appointment and being chosen by one's tutelary deity, there is a moment of illness, or a series of moments of illness, that point to an ordeal that culminate in madness. And it's after illness and madness that one makes a pact to become medium, and the illness subsides. And so there is a link between the language of madness and mediumship. And then in the hospital itself, I think the mediumship and possession and consultation practices, that those kinds of languages drop into whispers, in a sense. People know that the psychiatrists don't necessarily condone those practices, but at the same time, the psychiatrists live in the same world and are very well aware of these practices. And then patients who are there at the ward who I spoke to, many of them, but not all, would describe their experiences in terms of possession or seeing ghosts or bumping into a ghost. That was one of the common phrases, was colliding into a ghost. But also not everyone. And so the chapter that I focus on on a sort of constellation of cases at the hospital is where I actually use the hospital space to think about generationality and this form of impasse, but in a slightly different way than kind of alongside the cosmology, and the sense that that there was an impossibility of care between the generations in the middle of out-migration movements, so that families were often dispersed in space. And also, even if families wanted to care for one another, whatever that would mean, their registers of care became illegible sometimes to one another. So that I write, for instance, about the case of a young girl who dropped out of high school and was trying to find her way back into school and dreamt of going to college in the big city. And she kept speaking about her quote unquote textbook peasant father, who she just couldn't stand because she felt like he couldn't give him the quote love that she needed, the affection, the paternal love. And at the same time, I knew from speaking to people that were somewhat more of the, you know, occupational and social class as her father and that generation, this kind of bourgeois language of love and care and affection was not of their time and not of their class. And so there was a gap between what she desired, which came in the language of, like, this is looping back to the beginning of the young people I met in Shenzhen. She said, I would love to have a psychological consultation with a Western style psychologist, but that doesn't exist here. I would have to go to Beijing or Shanghai. And at the same time, someone like her father would not be able to, the way that he would address her, his care for her would be precisely through money. And so he was someone who worked in the field as well as in wage labor. And so she, something that struck me that she kept going back to was a refrain: when he talks, all he talks about is money. And so I think that for me in the hospital, what I encountered was these kind of breaks and impossibilities between the symptom of one of the members of the family, but what it spoke to were these layered generational issues that were resonating as well at the Temple Square, just in a different register. Yeah, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. And it's a really kind of novel, a fascinating lens on something which I suppose is quite widely discussed, or you know, people are more broadly aware of it, the idea of a generation gap, you know, the idea that the kind of incredible socioeconomic changes that have happened in China have kind of created these quite deep chasms between people of different generations. That isn't necessarily something that's used to many people, but I think the way you kind of are able to frame that by looking at it, you know, looking at differences in expectation, differences in languages and practices of care, specifically through, I guess, a sense that is shared by different generations that things are out of whack, things are out of joint, you know, that both, so you actually manage to level things quite well, or at least like give everyone a sort of, I think, a voice through considering how these things are mediated through engagement with various other realms, in the case of spirit mediums or the language of psychiatric care and so on. It's a really compelling new lens on lots of those issues, which are so important and kind of familiar, I guess, to many people who've spent time working on China. But I guess, we're kind of coming towards our conclusion. Yeah. So I guess I thought I'd sort of finish up by asking you maybe to return a bit to, you know, a place like Hexian, that this kind of location and how it helps us to sort of reappraise some of these categories that you were sort of approaching at the beginning. And I mean, also because, you know, I think my personal sort of interest in agenda is quite sort of socialism focused, or quite interested in the figure of Mao and the question of these sorts of visions. Would you say that the kind of broader, you know, cosmological and psychiatric activities you encountered in this place tell you something new about visions of the future, of utopia, of any sense that there can be some new order coming, a return of a strong sovereign like Mao, or whether there's any prospect for actually kind of settling some of these things? That's a very broad and open-ended and possibly impossible question. But since we've, you know, talked about views of the past and so on, I just wondered if you had any sense of how that might look. How does the future look?
I don't know how the future would look in a concrete sense. And I think that that was also one of the themes for the mediums, is that there's this sense of, there's a sense of prophecy. And I was just reading Blanchot on prophetic speech and the question of how prophetic speech actually, what it does isn't simply to tell one what's coming next, but what it does is actually implode and take away the present as it's usually given. And so I think that there's a sense in which mediumship takes away so many, in the way that I experienced or encountered it, at least, it took away so many givens that people seem to assume, which is that socialism is something that's far past, Mao is something that's far past and outmoded, and that, or even the idea that the Maoist state is necessarily secular, which is so much assumed, and Maoist policies were necessarily, that there's only a secular anti-religious reading of such obviously anti-religious campaigns. If even that can be turned upside down through the cosmology, then not much is given that can't be transformed even from its own languages. And so if even temple destruction campaigns can be read as divine intervention in a particular moment in which China was about to cave to the demonic spirits of the West, which was the reading of those campaigns, then I think it opens up time in a completely different way, which is not to say what comes next in a completely calculable way, but what can we assume about the past and the present? And the present, which then entirely transforms what could come in the future, I think, to me.
Mm. Mm. Well, and it, I think, gives a new centeredness to these people who live in a place which, as you put it in the codity of the whole book, that are people who are seen as remaining behind, as in some ways, I guess, part of a left behind China, as you described at the start there, somewhere that is not necessarily the focal point anymore of the big story of China. And so, to kind of center some of people in this place's efforts and projects to reappropriate, or maybe that's too strong, but at least, you know, have a strong interpretive framework through which they are understanding their present and indeed their future, I think, also makes this entire thing a very valuable exercise, quite apart from its, you know, fascinations in all sorts of areas. So thank you very much, Emily, for speaking to us about that today. Before we let you go, though, perhaps I could ask what has come next, on the docket, or what's followed on from this book, and what are you up to at present?
I guess since that project, I've been kind of hopping around on a couple of collaborative projects. I was part of a collaboration at Stanford that was led by Tanya Lerman that we've come to call the Mind and Spirit Project. So that brought me toward the theme of charismatic Christianity in China. And so in that project, we're thinking about the religious experience and sensorial embodied experience across different contexts and in different national contexts. So recently I've been on a project at the University of Amsterdam led by Esther Pierden that's called Imagining the Rural in a Globalizing World, where we're rethinking the tendency to center the city as the sort of core of globalization, when in fact the quote unquote rural is the sort of belly and supply of, whether it be labor, resource extraction, et cetera, of a transnational globalized world. So that turning away from the city as the emblem of the global, and the question of what has been changing in village landscapes, and how did village landscapes themselves actually speak to the global scale. And I think that very much came out of this project as well, which for me, Hexian is not a local place. It's a place that speaks to world history just as Beijing or Shanghai. So that's what I've been up to since the book.
Fantastic. Will we see, is there a book planned or some pieces planned from that project?
Yeah, there are some writings and articles out. I'm not sure how I would think about the next book quite yet, but those are the themes that I've been thinking about and patching together.
Brilliant. Well, no rush, obviously. I mean, it's not to put the pressure on. it's only last year, so you know, I think you've got a decade at least to come up with another one based on speed at which some people move. So great, thank you so much, Emily. I really wanted to express how grateful I am for you having talked to us today. Thank you.
And
listeners, many thanks to you too for listening, as ever, to New Books in East Asian Studies, It's a podcast on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you again very soon.